Ringler. This is Ringler Radio, a podcast where we keep you current on the latest news from the settlement industry, updates on nationwide litigation, trends in the legal and insurance industries, and everything in between. Ringler has been helping injured people and their families since 1975. So when it comes to objective settlement solutions, the consultants at Ringler are your go-to experts.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Ringler Radio. I'm your host, Phil Krauss.
And I'm Matt Ross. One of Ringler Radio's goals is to educate professionals and injured parties about settlement planning and all the tools used to reach an agreeable settlement. One common tool used in settlement plans sometimes involves Medicare and Medicare set-asides. Yet, there's often confusion surrounding the rules and compliance.
Today, we welcome Greg Bashaw from CP Resolutions to help us walk through understanding what CMS is and how it can be used effectively. Greg is the president of CP Resolutions, a company that focuses specifically on CMS and how to navigate its nuances and intricacies appropriately.
In this two-part episode, first, we'll take time to explain how Medicare came to be and how it can impact the settlement plan. Then, in part two, we'll dive into the proposed changes coming on the horizon and the impacts everyone can expect from those. Greg, welcome to our show.
Hi, Matt. Hi, Phil. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Thank you for being with us again. So, to get started, most people have heard the term Medicare before, but beyond that, have a difficult time explaining the concept. To level set for this episode and for our audience, could you take a couple minutes to tell us what Medicare is and why it exists?
You bet. So Medicare is a federally funded and federally managed, essentially, health plan, health insurance for U.S. citizens who are age 65 and up, or who are under the age of 65 and are on Social Security disability, or have had significant kidney issues that need a kidney replacement or on dialysis. And there are about 19% of people in the United States are Medicare beneficiaries. Because of the baby boomer generation, that number is growing quite a bit. So by the year 2030, they expect that 25% of the U.S. population will be Medicare eligible, which is an extraordinary number. About 10,000 new Medicare beneficiaries are coming on the books every day.
Sheesh.
Now, a lot of those Medicare beneficiaries are also passing away, so it's not, but the net numbers are going to go up quite a bit between now and 2030, and that's when the last year of baby boomers becomes Medicare eligible. Medicare was originally passed in 1965, which was the last year of the where boomers were born, and it was passed by actually Harry Truman, President Truman, so a long time ago. There have been a lot of updates since it was originally passed. They added Part C, Medicare Advantage plans, and Medicare supplement plans, Part D, prescription medication. But that's Medicare in a nutshell.
Well, Greg, thank you for those fascinating historical references. I'm a history buff, so keep it coming. And since our audience consists of both professionals, you know, settling claims as well as injured parties themselves, perhaps it would also help to explain why and how Medicare is involved in settlements.
It's a good question. You know, for a long time, Medicare really wasn't involved in settlements. And it's only been over the last, let's say, 15 years, 16 years that Medicare has really become more and more a part of settlements. Medicare is only a part of a settlement if the claimant involved is a Medicare beneficiary. So if you discover that claimant is a Medicare beneficiary, there are certain things that you need to be aware of as it involves the settlement. The first part, I like to put them into two different buckets. There's the pre-settlement thing that you need to really be aware of, and then there's the post-settlement thing that you need to take care of when it comes to Medicare. The pre-settlement part has to do with the fact that Medicare passed a law way back in 1980. It's called the Medicare Secondary Payer Law. And what that law states is that Medicare pays second. If there are overlapping coverages in a case where somebody has been injured in some way, the payment for that treatment, when there are these overlapping coverages, Medicare will always pay second, or if there's more than two, they'll always pay last. And so the way that translates in fact in a settlement is that Medicare has the right to be reimbursed for any payments that they mistakenly make for treatment related to an injury for which there's other insurance. Hmm. So I was referring to that pre-settlement part of it. So the parties are required, and in fact, let me back up and say this is an important point, that Medicare secondary payer law states in there that there are three parties who are liable, who are jointly and severally liable to make sure that Medicare is reimbursed. So that is the primary payer, which is either the insurance company, third-party administrator, the self-insured entity, you know, whatever you're dealing with, the plaintiff's attorney, and the claimant. So all three of them are jointly and severally liable for making sure that this happens. So Medicare pre-settlement, it is up to the parties. They have a proactive duty to reach out to Medicare once they know that the claimant's a Medicare beneficiary to find out if Medicare paid for any of these bills. And then Medicare will let them know if they are claiming that they paid for some of those bills. And then right after settlement, the parties are then required to pay Medicare for whatever Medicare is demanding that they be reimbursed for. So that's called conditional payment. That happens mostly prior to settlement. And then post-settlement, the law states that you have to consider and protect Medicare's interests even after settlement, if the settlement includes money for medicals post-settlement. And the way that's translated, in fact, has been in something called a Medicare set-aside, which is actually a really simple idea. It basically says, from the money that you get in a settlement, take the part of that that is intended to pay for Medicare-covered medicals and stick it in a bank account and only use that money for those expenses. So those are the two things that you need to be aware of: the conditional payments, the Medicare set-asides.
All right. So Medicare brings everyone together. And even though they may not want to be brought together,
we're all in this boat together.
Yeah, yeah. So whether you're defense plaintiff, doesn't matter. You are responsible to Medicare. Okay. All right. So can I ask a question more about Medicare set-asides, for instance?
Sure.
So how does one go about determining, A, if you need one, and B, how do you set one up?
Great question. So up until now, it really has only been standard practice to create a Medicare set-aside in workers' comp cases that are being settled. So liability cases up until now, it has traditionally not been the case that companies or the parties have created Medicare set-asides. The way that a Medicare set-aside is created in a workers' comp case right now is typically the parties will reach out to a company that does this for a living, and ask them to create a Medicare set-aside allocation report for them. And they'll send a referral to that company. The company will give this to typically a medical professional, a registered nurse who's licensed and trained in how to create a Medicare set-aside allocation report. And then what they'll do is they will follow Medicare's guidelines to create that allocation report, which is essentially an estimate of what Medicare-covered medical expenses that person is going to have for treatment related to the injuries from the accidents that's the basis of the claim mm-hmm. for the rest of their life. So typically, you'll have a rated age that will tell you, you know, how long they're expected to live, and then you estimate medical expenses until that rated age.
Okay. So since Medicare can be significantly involved with these settlements and MSAs are, you know, a prominent place, specifically in workers' comp, if the adjuster or the attorney don't necessarily have the expertise to help navigate CMS guidelines, how can Medicare kind of derail a settlement if certain rules aren't followed?
We've seen a lot of different ways. We've seen a lot of different settlements that have been derailed by Medicare over the years. Really, I put the ways in which Medicare can derail settlement sideways into three different buckets. So one bucket is when the number, so whether that number is the lien amount that Medicare is demanding that they be reimbursed, or the number related to the amount of the Medicare set aside, the amount of the funds that need to be set aside, when it's significantly higher than they expected. And so if they, so we've seen a lot of people who are just blindsided, who are having their settlement discussions with the insurance company. And they're, let's say they're talking about $150,000 and now suddenly Medicare comes back with a $180,000 lien. And okay, now what do you do? And so that, that scenario has happened and so that's, it just changes the discussion. Now, related to that is the second bucket of issues that we've seen, and that's the timeliness of when you're receiving that information as an attorney, as an insurance company, as a claimant. You'd like to know that information as early as possible so that you know what you're dealing with, so that you can take that into consideration in your settlement discussions. Because if you wait until the very end, and we see this all the time, that the parties wait until the very end, they've already had settlement discussions, they've basically come to an agreement of some kind, and now they say, okay, well, does Medicare have a lien? And now suddenly it's a big number. It can cause you to start completely over in those settlement discussions if it's something that you find out too late in the process. Yeah, that sometimes you forget about it, or maybe they've had experience where the Medicare demand amount just has never been anything significant, so they don't think it's that big of a deal.
Well, when I failed to do my homework in college, there wasn't a civil monetary penalty or fine associated with that.
Well, maybe your grade of F might have been the penalty, but not necessarily. Yeah. Monetary.
Yes, exactly. Civil corporal penalty or something. Yeah. Yes. So that's the third bucket is in how it can derail it is if the parties do something wrong. And we've seen this where let's take an example. You get to the very end and the demand for Medicare comes and one of the parties accidentally sends that check to the wrong recipient. We've seen it. We've seen Medicare checks sent to Medicaid. We've seen Medicare checks sent to Medicare corporate offices instead of the subcontractor's office where it's supposed to be sent. We've seen the payment being made on a estimate as opposed to a final demand amount. We've seen the parties pointing at each other thinking that each other is supposed to be paying that amount. But what can happen in those cases is it delays payment long enough, because if that payment's not made within 60 days of the final demand letter being issued, interest begins to accrue on day 61. And on day 61, after the final demand is issued, 61 days worth of interest accrues, not one day, 61 days. And now suddenly you have a different settlement amount, right? So now you have that settlement amount plus interest. And now what do you do? So who pays that? Where does that money come from? If in the release the claimant or and the claimant's attorney were required to pay that, all right. So do you got the money to do it? Those are the three ways that it can derail a settlement, and we have seen that happen, and we've seen it not a few times.
Great.
Well, all jokes aside, Greg, it sounds like being proactive can really help you get ahead of a lot of these issues.
That's exactly right. In fact, we really strongly believe that a best practice is to discover all these things early in the process, to find out what Medicare's interest, their reimbursement demand is going to be as soon as possible in the process. I think same with MSAs. If it's clear that the settlement amount in a workers' comp case is going to be above whatever threshold the parties have set where you'd want to create a Medicare set-aside, get it done early so that you know what you're dealing with, so that you have that information at your fingertips. At the end of the day, we as a company believe that Medicare compliance really consists of two numbers. It's that lien number and it's that MSA number, and you want to know those numbers as early as possible.
I mean, when you're going into negotiation, wouldn't you want to have more information than less?
Of course. Yes. And that's exactly right. And at the end of the day, what we do is, we do a service, but we're an information provider. We're providing good information for those parties to that settlement so they can make good decisions in their settlement.
So speaking of being proactive. There's, at least in my experience, depending on who you talk to, it's the old to submit or to not submit. So you make your MSA allocation, you find out how much that you're going to have to set aside. Some companies will submit every single one. Some may only submit a certain amount, and then some may not submit at all. So is there a rule or guideline or a best practice around that part of the MSA allocation that people should know about?
That's a great question. So just so your listeners understand, with a workers' comp case involving a Medicare set-aside, the parties have the option to submit that Medicare set-aside to Medicare so that they can review it and potentially approve it, or they could review it and make a couple of changes to it and recommend an alternative amount to it. But ultimately, at the end of the day, you have the option of submitting a set-aside to Medicare so that Medicare can give it a thumbs up. There are arguments for that, and there are arguments against that, and there are different. So some of our clients always submit their set-asides to Medicare for approval, and others kind of pick and choose, and others never submit it to Medicare. Mm-hmm. And so let me kind of run through kind of that decision-making process just real quick. The arguments in favor of submitting are that when you do submit and Medicare gives you the thumbs up, it is the ultimate gold seal of approval. And sure. At the end of the day, a Medicare set-aside is a risk mitigation tool. It's a tool, it's a tangible thing that shows Medicare that you've considered and protected their interests in the settlement in the appropriate way. And by giving that to Medicare for review and then they approve it, now they've basically said, you're done. You have mitigated risk to the maximum degree you possibly can. The arguments against are that often when you submit a Medicare set aside to Medicare or CMS for approval, that amount would be higher than what you might otherwise think it ought to be.
Shocking.
So, and you know what? And I understand Medicare is conservative.
Sure.
With that.
Of course.
They want to make sure that you've got that these set asides are amply funded. But there have been a few studies that have been done that have shown that these set asides that are submitted to Medicare for approval are way overfunded, up to maybe on average 25%+. And so for some parties, they say, well, you know what? That's too much. We're comfortable that if we create our own set aside and we are in good faith following Medicare's guidelines, and that amount ends up being somewhat less than it would likely end up if you submit it for approval, they're okay with that because they believe that they will have demonstrated to Medicare that they did consider and protect their interests in the settlement. And so some companies will say that perhaps for some where the risk is higher, where the settlement amount is above a certain amount, we're always going to submit. And then below that amount, we're never going to submit. But it's up to the individual companies, parties to kind of come up with a policy on what they're going to do when it comes to submission.
So, Greg, if somebody was looking to, you know, effectively bring somebody on to evaluate their policies, is there typically a cost for that? Is that something that, you know, you or another organization would charge to evaluate those policies?
You know, we don't charge for that consultation for our clients. And the reason we don't is these types of relationships, we believe that we're in it for the long haul and that we want to help them establish best practices and good policies so that they're consistently hitting all the marks for Medicare compliance. And we know that if we do that well with our clients, that it makes for a better relationship, it makes for a more consistent relationship, and it makes for our ability to give the guarantees that we give them. If we know that they're implementing policy consistently, we know that we can always keep them on the mark when it comes to compliance.
Great. Well, this has really been a helpful primer to understanding Medicare and its implications on settlements. So thank you, Greg, for your time today.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks, guys. Happy to be here.
In our next episode, part two, we'll be taking this conversation a bit further as we discuss the upcoming proposed changes to Medicare and how it might impact settlements in the future. Stay tuned.
Bye, everyone.
Before we go, we'd also like to thank our Ringler Radio sponsors, American General Life Company, Berkshire Hathaway, MetLife, Mutual of Omaha, New York Life, Pacific Life, and Prudential. Ringler is proud to partner with each of these companies as they provide competitive products for individuals seeking security for their financial futures. If you'd like to learn more about the services that CP Resolutions offers or how a Ringler consultant can help, check out the links in our episode notes or visit us at www.ringlerassociates.com.